This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
So, our first question comes from Simon Everett, who writes, "Thank you, firstly, for having this facility available to allow questions to be posed and hopefully answered. On watching Stargazing Live recently, and also from listening to a broadcast on Radio 4, I was very surprised to learn of the differences between the temperatures of the surface of the Sun and its corona. As a layman, this information would indicate that the corona is the driving force, providing energy to the surface of the Earth. It was also surprising to learn that the reason as to why these temperature differences occur is not, as yet, fully understood. My question is, however, if the corona did not exist, would the normal temperature found at the Sun's surface be sufficient to have allowed life to evolve, or allow life to continue on Earth? It's pretty amazing, as well as unlikely, that we exist anyway without this strange, as it seems to me, situation existing on the star that sustains us. Thank you in advance for your time and trouble."
Well, Simon is correct that the Sun's corona is much hotter than the photosphere, which is the surface of the Sun, or actually the layer of the Sun where the Sun becomes opaque. The photosphere is about 5,500 Celsius, while the corona is millions of degrees Celsius. However, most of the energy received on the Earth is actually from the photosphere and not the corona. This is because the corona is much thinner than the photosphere. As I mentioned before, the photosphere is the part of the Sun where the gas is so thick that it's opaque. The corona, however, is very thin and effectively transparent. Thick gases can more easily produce lots of thermal radiation than thin gases, so most of the energy from the Sun does indeed come from the thicker part of the Sun, the photosphere, than from the thinner part of the Sun, the corona. So, given this, life on Earth would generally be unaffected if the Sun had no corona at all and just had a photosphere. On the other hand, if the photosphere were to disappear, the Earth would get much cooler and a lot of life would die.
Our second question comes from Paul Stevenson, who'd like to know, "What is the mechanism that results in an elliptical galaxy when spiral galaxies merge?" He's got another question, but I think that one's a joke, which is that if the Mark 1 can pick up a mobile phone signal on Mars, why can't his mobile phone company get me a decent signal in Hertfordshire?
So the first part to understanding this question is to understand why spiral galaxies are flat spinning disks. While we don't know the exact details of how spiral galaxies initially formed, we expect that they formed by gas falling inward into some sort of high-density region in the primordial universe. So gas clouds are what dynamicists would call collisional, which means that if you have two gas clouds pass near each other, they're likely to hit each other and stop moving in opposite directions. When you have a lot of small gas clouds falling into a protogalaxy, what happens is that a lot of the vertical motion in the gas clouds is lost, and the galaxy is left with a rotating disk, which has a direction of rotation that is connected to random motions of the primordial gas clouds that fall into it. Elliptical galaxies, on the other hand, are thought to be formed by two spiral galaxies that have been around for billions of years, so a lot of the gas in the spiral galaxies has been converted into stars. When two spiral galaxies collide, disks are not necessarily in the same plane. So you have two disks of stars where the stars are rotating in two different sets of directions. And the galaxies themselves are probably moving around each other in a third plane, which is unaligned with the disks of either spiral galaxy. During the merger process, the two gas disks will typically smack into each other, and all the gas will fall into the center of the merger galaxy, and this will trigger huge amounts of star formation and may cause a lot of gas to be dumped onto a supermassive black hole or two black holes, possibly one from each spiral galaxy. When you dump gas onto a black hole, that effectively activates it, so you could turn it into an active galactic nucleus. You could actually have two active galactic nuclei. These would produce huge amounts of X-ray and radio emission and would actually be very bright objects. So the starburst and the AGN activity will blow most of the gas out of the center of the merged pair of galaxies. And so over time, with the merger remnant, you won't have any more gas present after this initial starburst. Or you may have a little bit left, but not a whole lot. Now, that explains what happens to the gas in the galaxies, but like I said, it's these spiral galaxies have potentially been around for billions of years, and they've already formed lots of stars. And the stars function a bit differently than gas in terms of collisions. Stars are what dynamicists would call collisionless, which means that if you have two stars and you sort of fire them towards each other, it's very unlikely that they're going to get close enough that they even gravitationally interact with each other. They're more than likely to just continue flying by each other. And it's almost certain that they're not going to get close enough that the stellar atmospheres of the two stars are going to smack into each other. So you have billions of stars in both the progenitor spiral galaxies, which are just going to pass by each other. Now, as I described earlier, you have stars in the two spiral galaxies more than likely rotating in two different directions relative to each other, and then you have these two disks of stars kind of moving in third directions relative to the rotation of the stars in the two progenitor galaxies. What this results in when you merge all of these groups of stars together is a huge scrambled mess. You just have stars going in various directions relative to each other. And so you effectively end up with a bunch of scrambled orbits, and you end up with something which is a disorganized ellipsoid of stars. Now, over hundreds of millions of years, the stars will eventually settle down. You'll have some other things which will appear when these galaxies merge, like you'll have some stars which are flung out in huge things called tidal tails, and then you may also have some shells of stars which appear, but over time, those features will disappear. And what you'll be left with is kind of this giant ellipsoid of stars left over.
And our third and final question comes from Russ Jenkins, who notes that it gets hotter the nearer you dig to the centre of the Earth, and asks, is the same true for Mars? Can Martian colonists keep warm and safe from radiation by digging down into the ground?
So, first of all, it took me a bit of work to find any information on this, but as best as I can tell, the interior of Mars is indeed hotter than the surface, although the interior of Mars is not quite as hot as the interior of the Earth. This is mainly because Mars is smaller. So first of all, it's been able to cool more efficiently after forming in the primordial solar system. And if its interior is heated by radioactive decay, like the Earth's interior, then there's generally less stuff there to produce heat because it's less massive. And you also have less material for that heat to escape through, so you'll end up with much cooler temperatures inside the Martian interior. Although, as best as I can tell, and there's potentially still quite a bit of debate on this, you could still have molten rock within the interior of Mars. So if Martian colonists were to dig deep enough, they would potentially find that the temperature would increase as they dig deeper. But they would potentially be warmer in a base which is just a few meters underground for reasons that have nothing to do with the geology of the planet, and for reasons that are very similar to why people on Earth could have warmer homes if they dig just a few meters underground. And that's because things that are underground are insulated by the rock on the surface, whereas things that are on the surface of planets are actually fairly well exposed and uninsulated. So during the daytime, things on the surface can be heated directly by the sun and can actually get much warmer. During nighttime, there's no insulation on the surface for things on the surface, and so they'll radiate away a lot of this heat. The same energy influx and energy outflow does not affect things which are buried just a few meters underground, so they'll actually stay at a more even temperature over time.